This is the course titled Finding Balance in a World of Extremes. It runs all week long, actually runs for 2 weeks. And my name is Bill Miller, currently serving as an associate pastor at Central Lutheran Church in downtown Minneapolis. Out of retirement, having retired from 21 years at Fairview Hospital as a director of religion and health in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I don't know if there's anything more I have to tell you about other than that this is the schedule for this week. If you're interested in following this track through, we're in here today with the first theme. And next door tomorrow at 6:15, you know, is that we jump around quite a bit. And skipping Wednesday because of the special 4th of July program and scheduling. Pick up Thursday back in here at 10:45 again. And Friday and Saturday next door in Fireside at 3:50 and 5:05. We have to watch the meal time times. In other words, if you want to catch this tomorrow, you'll have to eat at the 5 o'clock slot. And if you want to catch this Saturday, you'll have to eat at the late time, which is okay. Well, I don't know. I don't really like to sit. We're ready to record. And this is the first in the Finding Balance in a World of Extremes track, titled Neither Egotist Nor Zero Be. I want to propose to you certain theses or premises at the beginning out of which this all grows, namely that it's my observation that we do in fact live an awful lot of our lives in the extremes or very close to the extremes, most of the time without even realizing it or noticing it. And in order to, try to support this, I brought along a little evidence. Received in the mail one day in plain white wrapper, a simple technological revolution now makes it possible to obtain hardcore video films for 1/10 the normal price. The hottest, the newest, the best. Imagine less than $5 for the hardcore, full-color blockbuster Foxy Lady. And there was accompanying material that went along. Any of you ladies or gentlemen would like to review this after the session, you're welcome to. Interestingly enough, and the same day, and I ordinarily don't read Ann Landers, but on the same day that I received that, in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, a person wrote in and said, "Dear Anne, as a God-fearing, celibate, single Catholic woman who is sick and tired of all this hysteria about AIDS, I would like to have my say. If people would refrain from becoming involved in immoral activities such as premarital sex, extramarital sex, or marital sexual relations other than for procreation, they would not need to fear getting AIDS. Sex is for procreation only, otherwise it is perverted. Now before you say I am an extremist, let me assure you that the Pope and the Catholic Church are behind me. Signed, celibate Catholic - the only right way." I would suspect that that would demonstrate a couple of extremes, wouldn't you? I mean, this stuff on the one hand and this on the other? I think so. Some years ago, a fellow named Robert Ringer, who had written accidentally a big selling book called Winning Through Intimidation, wrote a second one called Looking Out for Number One. I didn't bring the book, I only brought the book jacket. Looking Out for Number One. And very clearly in the introduction, Ringer said, "I have to say," and this is the very first sentence, "I have to say right up front that any of you who know me at all know
that my primary motive in writing this book was to make as much money as I possibly could. And then perhaps you're familiar with this book by Robin Norwood, a very good one, Women Who Love Too Much, where she looks at that phenomenon within women. There are also men who fall into the same dynamics, but she is reviewing it in this book, looking at how women love too much, love to the extent, really, of sacrificing themselves, believing that they're doing right. And so here is one person who says, I am it, the only one, no one else even exists, let alone counts. And over here, she is suggesting that there are many of us who find ourselves way, way down at the other end, the other extreme, of where I will do anything for you. You might look, most of us are involved in working of some sort, and I think of the extremes in the world of work, where we have just blatant laziness at one end, total outright sloth. And that's a good word from catechism. Remember, I like that word. That's sloth. You can't just say sloth. You have to say sloth. And at the other end of the spectrum, at the other extreme, is the hyper-compulsivity. Or consider irresponsibility. I'm beginning to think that that's the way the world is going to end, by irresponsibility, ineptitude, and incompetence. People are totally, I think most people are trainees anymore who are in any kind of service. And at the other end of the spectrum, work addiction. People who have fallen into this really as an escape from the realities of life. It's just another addiction. Or think of one end, a grave dependent kind of stance where people, could you please direct me to the bathroom and help me? All the way down to the other extreme, which is that of total preoccupation with the job, whatever the job happens to be. Well, over the last 35 or so years, I've been observing how much we do tend to live in the extremes, or if not in the extremes, very, very close to them. And it's problematic. It's very problematic. Most of the time, we don't even realize it, because it has become our way of life. And it's only if there is some very, very embarrassing situation, or some trauma, or some tragedy that hits us, only then possibly do we begin to realize how much we have been in one of these extremes, or how much of our life has been lived so very, very close to one of the extremes. I mentioned addiction. You think, for instance, of people who are addicted and who have refused to realize how much they are living in an extreme, or extremes, plural, and how crazy their lives have been, how radically their lives have been affected by it, until they have been hit right square between the eyes with some kind of an intervention, some kind of an awareness now. Only after something like that happens, and that's a pretty horrendous kind of experience. The extreme becomes the normal. And someone calls it to your attention and you say, what are you talking about? That's the way it is. It's no extreme, that is the way it is. Or think of people who have spent their lives playing it safe all the way through, dwelling in the extreme of conservative safety. When we get down to the last one, the very last one in my series of 10, the title there is Galoshes, Umbrellas, and Motorcycle Helmets. Do we live at the extreme of riding our motorcycles full tilt with nothing but a bathing suit on? That's crazy risk-taking. Or do we have a sense of having to risk something in our lives in order to have a sense of fulfillment? One of the things that I have discovered is how easy it is to get into that rut of playing it safe. Did a little research and had the research affirmed by other researchers. Considering people who are moving into the latter years of life, what they complain about, what they wish they had done otherwise. And we discovered that the primary gripe or the primary wish I had to do with this matter of taking risks. People say, I simply did not take enough risks. Throughout my life, I played it too safe and consequently missed out on much of the fullness, the richness of the experience of life as God intends it for us. Incidentally, the second most prevalent thing that people state has to do with assertiveness. They will say, I was not assertive enough. I wish I had been more assertive in my years of living my life. And the third most common thing that people say is I did not practice enough self-discipline. I let things slide. If I had it to do over again, I would practice a lot more self-discipline. Now, we'll look at these all of these at different times during the week, but it's very interesting to see how, especially retrospectively, people can see how much they lived at one or the other ends of the spectrums. And I say, we don't realize this, how lopsided our life is until something happens and it's brought clearly to our attention. When you read the 10th chapter of the Gospel according to St. John, you get into some very picturesque imagery, seeing Jesus as the good shepherd who cares for the sheep so much that in fact he is ready to and does then lay down his life for them. And right in the middle of this good shepherd discourse, he says something profoundly important to us, and that really is the essence or the foundation of this whole presentation that I will be making. He says, all who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not heed them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved, she will be saved, and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they might have life and have it abundantly. And the key here is what the Greek word for abundantly is there. Perissos. And it's one of those words that don't translate easily in a word or two. Abundantly is an acceptable translation, and it certainly is adequate. But here are some other words that it also means. Over and above. More than is necessary. Super added. Mind, that's even in the lexicon. Super added. It sounds like a gasoline, a new gasoline on the market. Supreme. So you have to get this picture that whenever Jesus is saying, the reason I came is that you might have life, yes, but have it perissos. We get that image of like it's unlimited. And living out our lives at some extreme erodes away from that potential. What we have to do is to capitalize on what he says, to realize that in any facet of life, living in an extreme denies us the full potential of what can be ours, according to his words. You can consider really any part, any facet, any dimension of the experience of life as a continuum like this, and go on down one end to an absolute extreme of living it out, and then turn around and walk all the way down to the other end to its opposite extreme, and somewhere in between them is this sense of balance which every one of us needs to find and which is going to be different for every one of us. The point isn't, mind you, that somehow in all of these dimensions, all of these aspects of life, that we find the perfect balance.
That would be defeating the whole sense. It is simply that we bring these opposites together in a way and find some mid-path, our own mid-path. Maybe it'll be here, closer to that end. Maybe for the person sitting next to you, it'll be over here somewhere. But the point is that we review, that we look at those extremes and then see how we can bring them together. And when this happens and we find our own mid-path, we experience a wellness, a wholeness, a sense of completeness. The Greek teleos that Jesus uses, whatever he says, you must be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, doesn't really have a lot to do with moral perfection. It has to do much more with the sense of wholeness and completeness. Be whole and complete beings as your Creator designed you to be. And so we have this spiritual, social, emotional wellness, wholeness, completeness. And we look at these different facets and we see how easy it really is to slide into one extreme or the other. How easy it is to live out our lives without even recognizing that we're closer to one end or the other than to the middle. And then to see how we can bring those opposites together and find our own midpoint, our own balance in the midst of the extremes. This is a discuss it as we go course, which means the discuss it as we go identifies to you that you have to take the responsibility of moving in with a question or moving in with an observation or moving in with a challenge rather than saying we're going to hold off until the last 15 or 20 or 30 minutes or whatever and then discuss it. Yes?
Isn't it true, though, that most of the famous people in the world, like famous artists, musicians like that, were extremists? I mean, they were so immersed in what they were doing, they were ignoring everything else?
Actually, there is a very thin line between creativity and insanity. So that's my way of answering, you know, stating a response to your question. The answer, obviously, is yes. And whether that is the norm or not the norm is up for grabs. As far as I personally am concerned, in dealing intimately with people, it's not the norm. So while your observation is true, it's not really germane to what this is about. Okay? Are you tracking with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything else before we move on? This is all kind of foundational before we move in now to the very first one having to do with self-image. Yes?
Well, I was thinking it might be germane if one chose consciously to act in an extreme manner, that one might choose that, and that's quite different than being forced into it by habit or compulsivity or something. One might choose to focus in an extreme manner on something that you want to do, and that's different.
Oh, yes, yeah. Sometimes, however, creative people are driven. In fact, there is a dimension, and maybe some of you who are creative people can speak to this better than I. But as an author, for instance, I feel a sense of drivenness and struggle personally with having to lay that aside for a time being if indeed I wanted to do what I'm happy doing right now. Very, very interesting observations, though. Yes?
I guess for me the fear is that laying aside the drivenness may ruin the creativity or may let it.
Sure.
So it's a real struggle. It's
absolutely, yeah. I think being a creative person isn't a whole lot of fun sometimes. Really. Yes, sir.
I can recall my dream as a young lad wanted to be the starter on the high school basketball team.
Yeah.
So I would shoot baskets in my garage in midwinter, 30 below. My hands would freeze. My mother had to take my mittens off, take my shoes off, take my clothes off. I would shoot baskets year round. I would go to any extreme to be good, and I achieved that goal, and I'll never regret it. That's what I wanted to be at that time, and it was fun. It was a great trip. But it was an extreme.
But the question is,
What would you have been if you hadn't done that?
What would I have been? I don't know.
Yeah. That's the problem. You only live out one track. Yeah.
I might have been what my buddy was. He was in trouble with women.
Oh. You suppose we can move on? There are worse things.
I was just going to say that there's a danger of saying that having balance in our life means we don't have passion. I think we still want to keep our passions for what give us energy and touch, but we can still to find balance.
Right.
Our passion doesn't steamroll other people or steamroll taking care of our bodies or, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's a good observation thing. Maybe we can move on to the first one, which is our theme for today, that focuses on the dimension of our experience of life called self-image, how we see ourselves. And I chose to use the extremes of egotist and zero, neither egotist nor zero be in your image of yourself. The egomania extreme, it doesn't matter whether it's left or right, that's neither here nor there, but the egomania extreme is the I am the greatest, I can do anything, I am the epitome, the apex, the zenith, the acme of everything. When we are in the developmental stage of infancy, that fits. That's the way we survive. We don't know otherwise. As limited as our perception is in infancy, we don't know that there's anything other than I. And that's necessary for us to survive. But somewhere along the line comes the great revelation that I am not indeed the center of the universe, and that the universe does not orbit around me, that I cannot everlastingly have my own way. Some people don't really ever make that break and sort of remain stuck in this egotistic frame of mind. And if you turn around then and walk all the way down this particular spectrum to its extreme opposite, then you find the zero, which is just a round circle with nothing inside. I am nothing, I can't do anything right, I am the worst of the worst, I cannot stand myself. Words that fit over here on the egomania side are words like braggart and self-centered, pompous, haughty, insolent, snobbish, arrogant. Words and phrases that fit down at the other extreme are such as self-accusation, self-conviction, self-condemnation, self-hate, putting self down, as we would in the vernacular say, bad-mouthing oneself. Everyone else must come before me because I am the lowest of the low, least of the least, worthless of the worthless. Now, actually, the people over on the ego side are in the same boat as the people over on the zero side. And sometimes as I deal with people, I get to thinking that the people who are over on the egotist side are in worse shape than the people over on the zero side. One of the fascinating things is that we learn early in life how to masquerade. And so a lot of people who come off like gangbusters, steamrolling, bulldozing, are simply putting up a facade to cover a pretty weak and wobbly image and perception of self underneath.
Isn't that better than wobbling through life?
Don't know, because it can be very destructive. I can have a very, very wobbly perception of myself and come on like gangbusters and steamroll you and all the people in your row. And I don't think that's particularly nice. So I don't know, to answer your question, personally, no, I don't think that it's better that way. My perception is that, again, it's necessary to find a balance between these two opposites, to bring these together and find some kind of a midpoint.
Well, that's control.
That's what we're about. Yes, ma'am.
Have you found in your work any correlations that occupations, careers people may find with those attributes along that continuum?
No. Anybody else can speak to that? Whether there's any kind of correlation?
What did she say?
Oh,
she wanted to...
Go ahead.
If there was any correlation between self-image and the occupation that you choose. One is obviously jumps out right away is people in the helping professions, in all phases of helping professions, lean very strongly over towards the low self-esteem, not healthy self-image range.
Yeah. I think you notice a lot in comedians. In trying to put a self-image, and they run themselves down, and they run other people down.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it just seems to me like you see a lot of that in comedians.
Well, the idea is here that the best defense is a strong offense, you see. And if you can put that up, put that facade of great power and aggression up, then no one's ever really going to get close enough to look inside and say, holy mackerel, you know, there's a whole different self underneath that bulldozing facade, a self that isn't all that strong, a self that might be pushed over rather easily. And so the person who is doing this knows that, of course, and will keep everybody at arm's length.
So what you're really suggesting, Bill, is that it's not so much a straight line as it is a circle, and or at least a circle with maybe a small gap so that the jump from low self-esteem to the egotist is not that far, and that underneath the egotist perhaps is a low self-esteem person.
Probably not a circle, just a mask, just another persona. That many people down here in the egotist range are zero type people at heart underneath the mask. But what we see, the persona that we see, is that of the egotist.
I recall when Sally Fields won her Oscar. Didn't she? I can't remember exactly what she said now, but here was this outgoing, vivacious, talented actress who got up there and said, I don't deserve it, or something like that.
Do you really like me?
Do you really like me?
Yeah.
Like, you can't like me. Uh-huh. How can you like me?
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Or when I've seen a person who has been very extroverted, a leader, a speaker, mm-hmm. or something, you find out from their own confession that they're a very shy person. Mm-hmm. Very shy. Those two extremes are
not all uncommon. Yeah. It's been my experience, and of course my experience is limited, but it's been my experience that poor self-image steals away more of the sense of wholeness and completeness, more of the possibility of parasos than really any other dimension of life. Because it's so pervasive. And so, consequently, I have found most of my time being spent working with people to move up the spectrum from low self-image, poor self-image, and low self-esteem this way towards a more balanced sense of the perception of themselves. Sometimes I get to thinking, and I know this isn't right, but I nevertheless get the thinking that poor self-image is like the common cold. And it's not an on-again, it's not a constant thing, it is an on-again, off-again kind of thing. We go through life experiencing variations in our perceptions of ourselves, but I'm thinking more of the person who pretty consistently is looking in the mirror and going, blech.
Or would you say that both of those are not biblical, both of those extremes?
Would I say that both of the extremes are non-biblical? I would say that both of the extremes are undesirable. I think that neither of the extremes is what God intends for us.
Or what the Bible teaches.
Well, what God intends for us and what the Bible teaches probably would be pretty close together, I would suspect. I think of the range of this all through life, really, from infancy, all the way through the last breath. In parent-child relationships, seeking identity as you're a little kid, and hearing from mom and dad that you're a zero, that you really don't count, that anything you might have to say is totally irrelevant, so keep your mouth shut. Moving on into youth and adolescence, when we're really struggling to figure out who we are and what our sense of direction is, seeking identity. And then moving into, if we choose to court a member of the opposite sex and marry, how poor self-image or good self-image affects that. Poor self-image people put themselves down and make themselves available then to the egomaniacs who want to come in and really take over their lives. So much projection will take place then in marriage. As a pastoral marriage counselor, I see so many poor projecting and being projected upon. Yes.
Question, Bill. Are you talking now of the courtship or the relationship after marriage? The two people coming together, or not that time of courtship? Because in courtship, there's a lot of fear of rejection. Everyone tends to have fear of being rejected mm-hmm. by people, and when you're trying to get more intimate, your fear of rejection tends to be larger.
Way up.
Yeah, at that time. Mm-hmm. But after the courtship's over, you're now talking about the actual marriage, the people that tend to come together.
Beyond, yeah. But I've seen it both, before and after. And it's not the same, of course. But poor self-image person moving into a courtship relationship can indeed be picked up, so to speak, you know, not in a non-sexual sense, but can be picked up by someone who has a very, very powerful ego and wants to just glom on to somebody and make that person into a slave. And they fit, you see. That's one of the sick attractions. In fact, I had a situation with a couple where the man simply said to her, you will be my servant and you will be my slave. And she said, yes, sir. Because she perceived that as her role, given the image that she had of herself. Sometimes in the language that we have, we will adore the other. We will admire the other. We desire the other. But love, no. We can't really love in the Christian sense until we love ourselves. That's one of the big problems of this whole thing. That sometimes we delude ourselves into thinking we can see our own selves as a clinker and see everybody else as a glittering jewel. That's not the case. I'll quarrel with you with that one to the death. Because I have dealt with too many, many people who believe that, only to find themselves just steamrolled. My quip about that is that we lie back on our backs, smiling up through the heels of people who are walking all over us. I do not think that that is what Jesus meant by parousos, by the abundant life. I've lost track of which is which here. That's the extreme of the zeroism or zerohood. Chemical dependency. I have never, ever, and if any of you have, share it, but I have never dealt with an alcoholic who had a positive self-image. That is, prior to an intervention. I have never. Has anyone here ever? Or anybody in chemical dependency? No, I haven't.
sometimes people will fall ill in order to gain some love, because their image of themselves is so bad that they cannot, will not, seek and gain love and respect as a person of reasonable self-image.
Then the question is, can you believe in God if you don't believe in yourself?
Holy mackerel. Where are you getting these things anyway? Can you believe in God? Well, I guess I have to throw it back in your court and say you'd have to tell me what you mean by believing in yourself. Because I think, as I understand the scriptures, it works the other way. The only reason, and this is foundational to any kind of self-esteem, the only reason that we can have high self-esteem and consider ourselves literally as the apples of God's eye is because of His love for us, because of His having brought us into being and given us all that we have.
Yes, but that wouldn't amount to anything if you weren't an important individual.
I am important because of that. I think you're getting it, the cart and the horse backwards.
Well, would one be possible without the other?
I think that a lot of people who have high regard of self and move into the egomania realm are people who, in a sense, have disregard for God. And in a sense, thumb their noses to God and say, ha-ha, I've got it all, I really don't need you. The converse of that is what we call self...
depreciation.
Yeah, but it's false humility. False humility, that kind of gimmickry which tends to put down achievement and accomplishment whenever it's recognized. Yes?
I'm a drug addict recovered, and when I went through my real low self-esteem era, when I felt like a zero in my life for many, many years, as I look back on it now, I always believed in God, but I didn't know how to love Him because I couldn't love myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated Him, mm-hmm. but I believed in Him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very important facet. I wish we had more time to spend on that. If I cannot love myself, I cannot love other people. If I cannot love myself, it will be very difficult for other people to love me. Very difficult. And ponder on those two observations, and maybe somewhere on down the line we can wrestle with them a little more. But I wanted yet this morning to look at sort of the how come and what to do dimensions of the whole matter of where we shake out on a healthy midpoint in between these two extremes. One of the things that I discover in the church is that we rather arbitrarily select one of the extremes as desirable and the other as undesirable, and we tend then to avoid completely the undesirable one. So in this case, it would be that we would select the zero end and say, you know, after all, we are supposed to be nothing. Everyone else is supposed to come ahead of us. The first shall be last, last shall be first, etc., etc., and have then nothing to do with the other extreme of egomania, which I think is unfortunate that we do that. But my observation, again, my limited observation has been that in the Christian church we do have a tendency to do that. Instead of finding the value in each of the extremes and bringing them together, we say, ah, this is the one, and had nothing to do with this over here. There are probably as many reasons for poor self-images as there are people who have poor self-images. But in studying it and researching it, they always tend to fall into clusters, these things. And I have five pretty broad baskets, or clusters, or if you will, reasons of how come we do in fact have poor self-image. And the first is the influence of home and family. And that's reasonable because that's the most profound experience that we have early on in life, in the most formative portion of our being. Not everybody who is a parent or the rearer of a child ought to be. Because not everyone who has a kid really wants a kid. And sometimes that expression will be very, very overt. Like, I have no idea why we had you in the first place. Or life really dealt us a rotten hand, kid, and you're the worst card in it. we're not nearly as shocked, I think, now in 1990, to hear me say that, as we might have been shocked in 1970. People were still saying that to their kids in 1970, but nobody wanted to believe it. No one would say, how could a parent possibly ever say, we've made a lot of mistakes in our lives, but I'll tell you, having you was the worst. And humor, of course, sick jokes. Mother saying to kid, why don't you go out in the freeway and play? Or a kid misbehaving on the airplane, why don't you go outside and play a little bit? Often our humor, in our sick jokes really points to a lot of deep attitudinal stuff. Yeah, people who are angry and hostile simply because of the way life has dealt them their cards. I'm dissatisfied. I'm basically, I don't like me, and therefore I don't like you, kid. There's nothing you can do to make me like you. So don't even bother to try, because the more you try, the more I'm going to say to you, you failed. These are the people who are saying to their kids, it's nice that you got an A, but you could have gotten an A+, couldn't you? And then we have moms and dads who are looking for fulfillment of their expectations. Living out their unlived lives. You will do what I was never able to do in my life. And of course, if the kid really doesn't want to do that, kids do indeed try to satisfy parents' wishes, by and large. I mean, that's pretty much a given.
Can't life be that perfect? Should all kids be planned?
Well, I don't know that is... I can't answer that. I'm not sure that really speaks to what I'm speaking to. Sorry, I don't think that's right on the money. Now, where the devil was I? Why, fulfilling expectations, yeah. And then failing to fulfill the expectations and seeing that no matter what I do, I can never satisfy mom or dad. A lot of these parents are pushers. They push their kids into things. And this continues on all the way through life. And so sometimes as therapists, we come across people who are in their 50s or 60s. Doing what mom and dad wanted them to do, not what they wanted to do, and being miserable about it because it never fulfills them. They never get the sense of predecessors. Home and family, a profound influencer on where a person is going to shake out on this spectrum. Then there's society. Second big element is society in general and religious institutions or people in particular. Society in general is not all that nuts about people who like themselves. Society in general would much rather have everybody going around like, well, I ain't all that good, rather than have somebody walk around and say, I have been blessed with a lot of wonderful gifts from God, and I choose to use them in a creative and productive way. Well, who does he think he is?
We're all waiting for Donald Trump to fall.
Isn't that right? We're all waiting for the card house that came in, and we'll all say, see? there is that's part of our human perversity.
by and large, now of course there are notable exceptions to this, and I know that, but I like to make broad sweeping generalizations. By and large, we're not all that interested in other people's achievements and accomplishments, but let there be a smattering of rumor or gossip about somebody's dirty laundry and what? I want to tune in on that. The word that has presented such a problem for Christian people is pride. And I put my neck way out by saying pride is a wonderful thing to have. We should indeed have pride. We must have pride. Pride in ourselves. Pride in our achievements and our accomplishments. The word that is the rat is arrogance. The seven deadlies shouldn't have pride in. The seven deadlies should have arrogance in, because arrogance is the self-centeredness. It's the Robert Ringer. I don't care what's in this thing. All I want to do is make mega bucks. This book. Arrogance is a grave sin, because it breaks relationships. It breaks my relationship with God, with you, with my own self, because I set myself up as some kind of a demigod. And consequently, because of the confusion, the Christian church, in my observation, has just gone berserk over all the centuries in discouraging people to have pride in themselves. Do not think more highly of yourself than you ought to think, said Paul. And I'm not sure that I really understood that ever, or that I ever will understand.
The key word is then you ought to.
And you ought to, whatever that means.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's relative.
It's all relative, mm-hmm. Yeah. But there have been too many situations, too many experiences where a powerful influence, like the church, in the form of a Sunday church school teacher or a pastor or some literature or a wall hanging or whatever, there have been far too many of these that have encouraged us to put ourselves down with just across the board saying, this is what you ought to do for the common good. And that's what causes a lot of people to get into this thing called false humility. Which turns out to be the third big reason why people have poor self-image. The acceptability of false humility. And I want to warn you, false humility can get you into a lot of trouble with God. Because false humility is actually to, in a sense, vulgarly spit on the gifts of God. Now let me try to spin that out before you get too bent out of shape. Supposing that, we just heard the Evergreen Brass. They're good. They're really good. They're talented, gifted people. Supposing I go to the trombonist and I say, you really have a talent. That was marvelous. And the trombonist says, oh, it's nothing. It's no big deal. You know, really anybody can do it. What do you suppose is going on in God's head whenever God hears that? Because what is he saying, essentially, other than that, you know, this gift of being able to play the instrument really isn't that all that swift. Does that make sense? It makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah.
One little comment on that type of thing, not accepting a compliment.
Yeah.
Is that really you're telling a person who's giving it, he doesn't know what he's talking about.
You don't know what you're talking about. Let me straighten out your thinking. You think I just played that well? Oh, let me straighten you out. I didn't play that well at all. You know, if I had worked a little more diligently now, and I'll show you right here in the music, down at the bottom of page 4, you know, I'd have hit that B flat instead of a B natural. And people do that, and it gets reinforced, you see. That's why I say the desirability, the acceptability of false humility is what generates or exacerbates poor self-image. And we just keep feeding into it.
At the same time, what if we were to react and respond by saying, you obviously recognize a God-given talent?
Well, that's his way of getting God credit.
How would we react to that? We would
or you say, you don't even have to say that. Say it's a God-given talent. You say, I'm glad you like that. You know, I worked my fingers to the bone preparing for this, and it would have been a catastrophe if nobody would have come to me and said, boy, you really play the trombone well. That's the other extreme. And so we find in this particular illustration the balance of pulling those together and saying, thank you very much. I'm glad that you enjoyed the performance. I'm glad to hear you say that. And with grace, graciously we accept the compliment, knowing that it's a gift. The talent, what we have done because we have been gifted, we have been blessed. I really don't think that we have to get up and say, No, soli Deo Gloria, give God the glory. No, I don't think that helps self-image. I think what we do is say, thank you very much. Yes, I do have a talent, and I'm glad I have a talent. I'm glad God has given it to me. I'm glad I've chosen to use it in a creative and constructive way. Thank you.
I think that's one of the problems, though, in terms of those who are in the extremes of how that message of grace can be proclaimed.
Right.
Because the people on the one end don't believe it's necessary because they've got everything together anyway. And the ones on the other end can't believe it's true because it can't be.
And why haven't we helped people as a church, particularly in Christian education, why haven't we helped people over the years to be able to do that, to graciously accept that in some kind of midpoint, without on the one hand either going, like a shriveling grape leaf on a vine that's just been sprayed with weed be gone, you know, like that, or a hot potato, I don't know what to do with this. Yes?
I hear what you're saying. I have a little trouble at this point with, I have learned to say thank you for the gift. I thank you for the compliment. I appreciate that. And I see that as healthy. But the other part of me wants to give God all the glory, and I mean that from my heart, that whatever I have is a gift from Him. And
I
will also tell it to people, hey, I can't take the credit, it's God. But you're saying I'm putting myself down.
All I'm saying is, you can do that privately. You can, in the privacy of your own thoughts and prayers, give your full thanks, do your soli Deo Gloria.
I will tend to do that publicly at times too, though.
Okay. You can do that, but don't give me the thanks. Give God the thanks.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Okay.
One of the old confessions we had when I was a young kid that we learned in the hymnal.
Yeah.
Was the confession starts out something like, "I poor miserable sinner confess unto thee," and etc. 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 That wasn't that miserable, really.
Well, you probably weren't poor either. Maybe. we can go back, and it would delight me to no end to spend an hour with you looking at old Lutheran hymns. Ooh-wee. Of what real, and I shouldn't make fun of it because it has been very, very damaging over the years. And any of you who deal intimately with people know full well how many people have been damaged severely by unhealthy religious input. Beneath the cross of Jesus, two wonders I confess. The wonder of His glorious love, and the old version, and my own worthlessness. That was heresy. There's no question about it, because there is nowhere in God's revealed word that you will find God saying to us, you are worthless. Now, when the new SBH came out, they got rid of that. You want to know what pornography is? That's pornography. That's religious pornography. You know, worthless. And changed it to two wonders I confess, the wonder of His glorious love and my unworthiness. That's good theology. Yes, we are unworthy. But we're talking about sunrise, sunset distance between those two concepts. And so you have a person who's got a home situation where he or she isn't getting all that much positive stroking. In fact, there's a lot of negative stuff about, kid, you really don't count. You're just a pile of crap. And then goes into church and hears people sing with great gusto and my own worthlessness. That's terrible. That's too bad. And I don't know why, except for the real raging fear that we've always had, I guess, in the church, in the Christian church, all the way back to the beginning with Paul, that if we ever allowed people to have positive views, images of themselves, that they would run into the egomania realm and all be arrogant anarchists. Okay?
How
yes.
About
the... Got one?
Okay.
What I find curious is that with all that, what you're saying, I think, is correct. But why do we tend to gravitate as people towards those people who carry their pride well, are good at handing out compliments, are gregarious, energetic kinds of people that seem to be pretty well focused in the center mm-hmm. of this continuum? Mm-hmm. Why do people generally gravitate towards those kinds of people, enjoy being around those people, but don't choose to emulate mm-hmm. that? What drives people away from that, even though they see that, they enjoy that, but they don't mm-hmm. choose to emulate that?
And what they will say is, if only I could be as you are, could do what you do. Why? Because they, well, first of all, they're attracted to this because of its health. It's a very healthy and desirable place to be, and they unconsciously recognize that this is perisos. And why don't such people do it? Well, there is oddly enough, there is a certain payoff for having poor self-image. There's a certain desirability about it. So we ought not to think that as soon as someone recognizes that maybe a big problem in their lives is seeing themselves as less than they can see themselves, that all of a sudden they're going to turn around and move in that direction. No, because poor self-image will allow you to get out of a lot of responsibility. Avoid a lot of responsibility that would normally be yours. If you present yourself as I'm just a this, or I'm just a that, or I could never do this, or I could never do that. Or if you hand me the ball and I drop it, they say, okay, Miller dropped the ball. Hand me the ball a second time and I drop it. Okay. If I drop it the third time, chances are nobody's going to hand off the ball to me anymore. So I don't have to worry about running down the field carrying that ball and getting creamed. Now, that's kind of a crude illustration. But nevertheless, people with poor self-image, identified poor self-image, may not choose to move towards the midpoint because you would have to give up a lot of your goodies. You might not be surprised about how many people will very much hesitate to be well physically, health-wise, because then you don't get any attention. Then you can't have any time off. People who don't have positive images of themselves really have a hard time taking time off from the job or getting out of the stressful situation. They do not have enough self-esteem, enough ego out of that self-esteem to say, I need to do this. And it is appropriate. Rather, what they will do is get it in a sanctioned way, sanctioned by our society, and that is to fall ill. And we get into the whole realm of emotionally induced illnesses then, and that's good for another afternoon. But there are plenty of reasons why a person who can look at a midpoint and say, boy, that would be nice, either will not or find themselves unable to do it. Lots of reasons. We're at our quitting time, and we didn't get nearly as far as we might have, but that's okay. We'll wrap up for today. And we are not allowed to talk after the session either, because you have to get on over to lunchtime so that the serving can begin promptly. But if you want to talk about any, I'm obviously around, any of the stuff from this morning, don't hesitate to buttonhole me and we'll do it. Looking ahead, if you're interested, tomorrow is a fascinating one. Absolutely fascinating. It's my most exciting one. It's the area where I've done an awful lot of work having to do with the dark side of personality, the shadow side of personality.
Even tomorrow, we aren't going to, after we talked about the person that puts himself down, you aren't going to talk about the, what they, whatever, the other side
got,
of it?
Got a good 30 minutes worth of that, and we're just not going to make it. That's why, if enough of you are interested in that, we'll get a rump session going and do it. But we have to do it this way. We have to have the interaction. We have to allow you to make your observations and ask your questions. So tomorrow we get together next door at 6:15, out of the darkness into the light. See you then.